Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
I believe united we stand, and we have common ground to find, and we're going to find it. We're not
even going to be
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, recapping a week that saw both the Senate and the Assembly in session, but first, wish I was there. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Democratic Rep. Steve Doyle on the special needs of Democratic Representative Jimmy Anderson. That's a topic we'll spend some time on in this show. I asked the co-chair of the Task Force on Suicide Prevention why five of the six counties with the highest suicide rates are north of Highway 10, and Senators Howard Markline and Chris Larson on who benefits from the manufacturing and ag tax credit. Wish I was there.
When Representative Anderson was first elected, as I talked about, we sat down, we figured out ways to make sure we had every accommodation. We said yes to all of his requests at the time. I think it was an unfortunate way to go about it, rather than sitting down as colleagues to say, well, what can we actually do that would accommodate your needs, but also keep something that was unanimously adopted by the Assembly as a concern, watching how our colleagues in the Senate operated.
The majority has the right to decide, but the minority has the right to be heard. And this proposal, the proposed rule change, really undercuts that. We have one member who's being held hostage at their whim, and they are trying to undercut our constitutionally protected right, and that's not correct.
I had teachers in high school that never understood why some of their kids never showed up to class when they didn't know that the kid was fighting a lot of problems at home. I know that there are thousands of little boys and girls out there fighting depression, abuse, and suicide alone that don't have the accessible resources because they can't afford a therapist. Passing this bill would equip all staff with the knowledge and resources they need to safely and effectively support every child that needs it.
The western United States has higher rates than the eastern, urban, all across the United States has higher rates than urban. Some of it is probably because those professionals aren't there. Some of it's probably because of the occupations of those individuals, farmers, ranchers, lumbermen, people that are feel them they're more self-reliant, so they're trying to take care of things themselves. They not so much they don't have the access, but they don't ask for the help.
I probably represent the most agriculturally dependent Senate district in the state of Wisconsin. My guess is you probably don't have as many farmers in your district as I do, Senator. But you know things aren't real great out there, in the ag front. So. I look at this as anything we can do to correct what I think was an oversight with the ag credit. I don't have a problem doing that.
I think the last DOR data we have says the state's top 1% income earners took home 88.5% of the funds. And I've got to believe more of those folks are in my district than yours.
As I said in the open, it's been a few months since we saw both houses, Senate and Assembly, in session. Late June, when they voted on the budget, correct?
A little more than three, yeah.
A little more than three. Okay, let's talk about the Senate. So the Senate came back. They confirmed five of the governor's cabinet secretaries. I still think this leaves nine or
so. It depends on who you want to include in the cabinet or not, but yeah, roughly.
Okay. And they passed the bill that's compromised with the attorney general, imposing deadlines to test rape kits and requiring results to be kept 10 years and giving victims options. And they conformed our hemp growing law with the new federal standard. Anything I miss on the Senate action?
A couple of the kind of oddities that maybe just geeks like I pay attention to, or geeks like me. Remember we talked about the standard for Fitzgerald of 17 votes from the Republican caucus to pass anything?
Yes.
Sheldon Wasserman, former Democratic lawmaker from Milwaukee, confirmed the medical examining board 27-6, six no votes, all from Republicans, all over his background as being an abortion rights supporter. Rare to see six of the 19 vote against something and it pass, even come to the floor. Fitzgerald told me that, yes, that concern had been raised, but not really till before they went to the floor. So that's why that got on the floor, despite the opposition. Second thing, there's a bill to expend two tax incremental districts in Lake Delton, part of the Dells area. That also had three no votes from Republicans, left it below the 17-vote margin. So a little bit of an interesting, for somebody like me, who sees how things operate, that those bills both made the floor.
Okay,
things,
and
things made the floor.
This was the first time the Senate was in session since Fitzgerald became a candidate for the 5th District U.S. House seat. Mm-hmm. So my question, J.R., are we seeing a more approachable Scott Fitzgerald, because he had to take a question on impeachment. He called it a witch hunt. And he then, the next day, sent us photographs meeting with two Catholic leaders. And he also got out in front on the F-35, which we're going to get into later. Mm-hmm. So are we seeing a different Scott Fitzgerald now that he's a candidate for the House?
Not really in the building so much. But what we are seeing is somebody who's commenting more about federal issues than we saw before. I mean, because it wasn't really the purview of the state Senate to talk about those things. But now he's running for Congress, seeing that a little more aggressively. Interesting side note, so Charles Franklin, the pollster for Marquette University, I asked him to look at the president's approval ratings in each of the congressional districts mm-hmm. over the last 3 years. And, you know, Charles said that normally with that, you kind of, it's such a long time period, it's kind of a hesitancy to aggregate stuff. But the president's been so kind of like stagnant in where he's at for his numbers, that it's actually not bad. What I'm getting at is in the 5th congressional, I also asked him, okay, now break down Trump just among Republicans. 84% approval rating from self-identified Republicans in that district.
In the 5th.
What I'm getting at is that, you know, for Fitzgerald, you want to be pro-Trump. I mean, yeah, the 5th has some of the suburban areas we've talked about being problematic for Republicans compared to, like, you know, 10 years ago because mm-hmm. the Trump brand has damaged the GOP brand. But in that primary, it's not a problem to be pro-Trump at all. In fact, you need to be pro-Trump pretty much in any Republican primary right now. If you're running for Congress.
And we heard Senator Fitzgerald call it a witch hunt in Washington. Okay, let's turn to the Assembly. I want to handle this two ways. I want to deal with the debate over the accommodation for Representative Anderson, who is tragically paralyzed, mm-hmm. and then we'll get to the process. But first, let's hear the exchange between Majority Leader Steinicke and Representative Anderson just on the issue of accommodating his special needs. Please.
Got a letter from Disability Rights Wisconsin. Specifically to Representative Anderson's request for accommodations. So when we got that letter, we went about trying to do the best that we could to accommodate those requests. So the representative from the 32nd and I sat down and started peeling through the rules to figure out how we can address the first issue dealing with committee hearings and execs, and the second issue dealing with overnight or extremely long sessions. And I'm glad we're putting these provisions into place because it isn't about one individual, and we're all going to vote for it. I hope you guys all do too, but I'm guessing you're not going to, and that's unfortunate. But we did our best. We tried to meet everyone halfway. And again, we were just rebuffed. It's just become a common theme over the course of the last 9.5 months. I hope it changes because I think it's important.
The reason why I'm in this wheelchair is because a drunk driver ran a stop sign at 60 miles an hour when I was on my way to celebrate my birthday with my family. On that day, my entire family was taken from me. And I suffered a complete spinal fracture at my C4 vertebrae, and it left me as a quadriplegic. I will never walk. I will never use my hands. I will never be able to enjoy my life as I once did. When I'm asking for these accommodations, it is not because I am trying to be selfish. It is not because I'm trying to disrespect the office or this building. I am asking to be included in the legislative process to the best of my ability, and to think that I would be disrespectful to this building offends me to my core. If you have any respect for me as a fellow colleague, if you respect me as a human being, if you think that I deserve the simple decency of being able to vote for my own disability accommodation and resolution, turn this down. And let's find another way.
It took two votes, but the Assembly did change their rules. One of those rules will allow Representative Anderson and any future member of the Assembly who's disabled to call in. Mm-hmm. Now, what's your take just on the debate over Jimmy Anderson, who ended up having to vote against the change that will let him to call it, that will allow him to call in committee meetings.
Well, let's recall that Robin Voss was adamant this summer, when this first kind of came to light, that he did not support allowing members to call in to assembly meetings.
Which is done in the Senate.
He thought it's disrespectful to those who show up, take their time to come down to the Capitol and testify. My impression is that despite that stance just a couple months ago, assembly GOP leadership realized that if they didn't change this, they'd face a lawsuit and they would likely lose under the Americans with Disability Act. So this forced them to find an accommodation for Jimmy Anderson and these other changes that were paired with it that some people I've talked to, they feel like some of the GOP leaders under Robin Voss wanted their pound of flesh from Democrats for having to give in on this piece. Now, you can argue that these changes will make the chamber run better, those kinds of things, but by pairing them with the accommodation, you have made a lot of people in the Republican caucus uncomfortable about having to defend allowing, you know, an unlimited override votes while trying to accommodate somebody who's paralyzed to do his job.
That's what I want to ask you about. So when Representative Anderson, that very emotional testimony, talked about seeing the lifeless body of his brother after that accident, and then went on to say it takes me 4 hours from 6 to 10 to arrive here at 6 a.m. to 10 to arrive at a 10 o'clock session, very emotional stuff. Is that a major PR defeat for the Assembly Republicans, J.R.?
Well, see, what's interesting to me is that, and I've asked people about this, is that this stuff doesn't matter if you get one block off the Capitol. I mean, I don't think this drives a campaign. Nobody's going to lose an election or this vote about rules. It put Republicans on the defensive a little bit about this issue. But let's be honest, you know, Jimmy Anderson saw an opportunity politically to make Robin Voss look bad. I mean, I'm not saying that this is all about that.
But he also said in his speech, I asked about this in February. Mm-hmm. I got no response. I asked about this in March. I asked about this in April. And yes, then I did finally, after getting no response for months, then I went to the press corps.
Absolutely. And again, feedback I got from people is that Jimmy managed this quite well in like making his case. But he also saw the opportunity that, you know, this puts Republicans on the defensive. So let's not make anybody out to be a saint or a sinner here completely, right?
Okay.
No 100%. So that's what I'm trying to say.
All right. Now let's walk through some of the other changes. Allow repeated votes on overriding governor's vetoes instead of just one vote. Speaker Voss also said now that they're going to make a run at overrunning some of these vetoes maybe in November, JR?
Possibly. We'll see how that goes.
What's the logic here? Why take more than one veto override vote on a specific
veto? If you want, let's just take a like the tax cut bill that Evers vetoed, all right? If you want to, you could run that override vote time and time again and say, lawmaker X, who's in a swing district, vote against this tax cut, not just once, not just twice, but X times because...
it's like trying to kill the Affordable Care Act.
You could do something like that. Another option. I don't know how this all works. I'm not a lawyer, but what if... I think it's the number of people present in the chamber, right?
Okay.
What if Dems are absent? To lower the threshold, you can try and override it then. Now, I mean, honestly, like, this doesn't really mean much this session as long as Republicans are at 19-14 in the Senate. Because you have to have a two-thirds vote in both houses, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So barring a change over there, it's not going to matter. However, next session could be a different story if they bring these rules back.
But we've had no veto override since 1985, Tony Earle. Okay, let's
move. The closest one was on concealed carry under Jim Dole, survived by one vote in the Assembly, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, Representative Sherman cast
a vote. Ended up being a Judge Sherman.
And now Court of Appeals Judge Sherman.
Retired Judge Sherman now.
Retired Court of Appeals Judge Sherman.
That's how long we've been around, Steve.
Yes. thanks for that reminder. Another change. Let the Speaker rule that calls to break for party caucuses would be out of order if the only purpose perceived by the Speaker is to delay action. Now, the context here is how do you want to avoid 10, 12, 18-hour assembly sessions, which does pose unique, painful problems on somebody like Rep. Anderson. Mm-hmm. So is this a major do assembly Republicans have major new powers with this change?
I mean, they would break for caucus once in a while during debate to try and figure out strategy.
But it's usually by courtesy.
Yeah,
the speaker would say, okay.
The thing, Robin Voss, when he first became speaker, he wanted to professionalize the assembly operations because you and I both remember years ago, they wouldn't start until even, like it wasn't until 5:30, 6 o'clock for even walk on the floor sometimes on a session day.
Yes.
We'd be up to 1, 2, and 3 o'clock morning regularly. He wanted to change that, the dress code, all these things he did implemented to try and professionalize his chamber and make it run like Congress in his mind.
Yeah.
To some people, the move to go to caucus repeatedly is just a delay tactic. It speeds up the process, and Democrats would argue tramples on the rights of the minority.
Okay. Under the rule change, it would let the GOP impose time-limit debates if both parties can't agree. Now, we had two sessions where there were memos of understanding in terms of how much time they were going to spend on a specific calendar. Now, there hasn't been that agreement this session. So as a result, the GOP leaders are now empowered to set time limits.
Remember 2011, the debate over Act 10 that changed collective bargaining for public employees, that stretched 4 days, essentially, right?
Yes.
These debates on time limit debates were meant to try and avoid situations like that. They negotiated for a while, but the relationship has been much, much less hospitable between the two sides.
As we're about to hear, you bet.
And I don't know who's to blame. I know they all have some beef against the other side. It goes back to the lame duck session, December of last year. Robin Voss won a unanimous speaker, vote for him as speaker. Dems said, no, we're not doing that after what you just did in December. I mean, there's been like this
Building animus.
Series of slights, yeah, perceived or real, going on for a while. And again, what I get back to is, if you walk one block off the Capitol, nobody gets offended by it. I mean, gets worked up about stuff because it doesn't affect their lives.
Yeah.
But for the people in this building, this is like real serious stuff, much like with the governor and the relationship between the executive branch and legislative branch. I mean, all the times the Republicans complain to me about the governor's not doing A, B, and C, none of the stuff that he's doing that they get upset about matters outside the building. This is a very inside baseball session to me so far with, like, what's the drama been about.
If you're using the baseball analogy, they're all throwing beanballs. Okay, one final change. Let the speaker order call of the assembly requiring all members to return to the chamber. This is a rare procedure. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. But I want to now let's play a clip between Democratic Leader Hintz and Assembly Majority Leader Steinicke, just indicating some of the animus that JR just talked about. Please.
Seems like you can't help yourselves at every opportunity. Well, if we're going to accommodate a member with disabilities, we better strip the minority of power. How does allowing for unlimited overrides have anything to do with the Americans with Disabilities Act? I'm trying to think, which part of the ADA says the speaker should have the ability to change the calendar unilaterally 24 hours before session? When I say dismantling this institution, disrespecting democracy, an absolute disgrace, something that will be looked back on as a dark period, no respect, that's what I'm talking about. Taking away things that have nothing to do with what we're talking about and that erode the process in our state of mutual respect.
Minority Leader said earlier, and I think he was just misinformed, so I want to correct the record. The 24-hour, he said that the speaker could run the assembly however he wants. Well, I got a little worried, because I thought maybe something was slipped in there. I went back and checked the language. It does not give him that power. It does, Minority Leader said that he could refer a bill to the calendar in just 24 hours. Wrong. So let's just get our facts right. I mean, this whole nonsense about corruption, all this stuff is just, it's ridiculous. Just focus on the issue. You don't want to vote twice on a veto override? Okay. We don't really want to vote 800 times on the things that you bring up all the time.
You had a quick PS on this subject?
So if you're really a legislative geek and want to geek out on this stuff, Glenn Gunther of the Wheeler Report did a great blog post explaining every rule change that was in the package and the practice as it's been and what the rule change would mean. So I encourage you, if you're a geek and want to geek out, go read Gwen's blog.
Okay, thanks for the shout out. Now let's talk to the resolution that passed, about the resolution that passed, both in the Senate first and then in the Assembly, asking that an F-35 squadron be in Madison. It was controversial. It passed on a voice vote, and then Senator Risser said, let the record show, and then it passed in the Assembly with eight or nine votes against?
So, yeah, something like that.
Okay.
Single digits.
And we are about to hear a press conference. I'm sorry. We're about to hear from Speaker Fitzgerald and Tony Kurtz, who was a helicopter pilot, and saying why we need these F-35s based here economically to keep Truax Field alive. But then you had this unique wrinkle from Assembly Democrats led by Chris Taylor saying 60,000 people live within 3 miles of Truax Field, and the initial economic impact study showed that some of those homes would be not livable. Before we go to the clip, what's your PS on the F-35?
What's been fascinating is the intense opposition that's very localized. If you live by the airport in Madison, this is a big deal to you. The debate about which one's louder, which one's going to have more of an impact. I mean, there are people who continue to argue that there's not really a change between the F-35 and F-16.
Right.
I mean, I live 3-point-some miles from the airport when the F-16 take off. I can hear them. They're pretty loud. I'm not right there when they take off. I don't know the science behind the two. Very personal, very local, intense feedback to this. Mark Bocan calling for more time to study this. I mean, it's a weird watching this dynamic of Dems kind of like, we want more study without saying outright, we don't want the military here because there are jobs. And also, Fitzgerald got to this in the floor debate in the Senate. It's not just about these planes. It's about the mission of Truax Field. We go through rounds of base closures every so often in this country. If you don't have a mission, you don't have a base. And he warned, if you have empty buildings at Truax Field, that means that base might go away someday.
Right, which is an ideal time to hear from Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald, Representative Kurtz, and Senator Risser, and Representative Chris Taylor on this very issue. Please.
It's not about what's going on up in the sky when it comes to the F-35. It's about what's going on in the ground. And it is, let's maintain Truax, let's maintain the buildings, the units, the civilian personnel, and the way to do that is by making sure that the F-35s are housed at Truax Field in Wisconsin.
The 115th, the men and women of the Air National Guard, they have stepped up to the plate over the years. It's not something the Air Force threw a dart at a map and said, we're just going to put a unit here. It literally took years of dedication of the men and women of the Air National Guard to achieve this esteemed honor.
You know, people say this is going to produce 1,600 jobs, probably, but it'll also affect 1,600 people that live close to Truax Field that are very concerned, quite frankly, about the possible effects of the noise, which we don't even know what the extent is to be.
There are so many other places these jets could go. They could go to other parts of our state without these substantial disruptions, without a disparate impact on the most vulnerable communities, without impacting our children's ability to learn. Do not consent to put them in a place that could ruin some of our neighborhoods, interfere with our children's ability to learn, cause someone to not be able to open their window. Who wants to live like that? Those are not the communities we want to create.
Okay, I need your help. I'm trying to understand why the Ron Johnson, Republican senator, who chairs the Senate Homeland Security Committee, went on Meet the Press last Sunday and said he doesn't trust, his words, the FBI or the CIA. Mm-hmm. Here's what intrigues me. Chairing the Homeland Security Committee, he has to get the best professional expertise from the FBI and the Homeland Security Committee. But he said last week, I've never seen a president's administration be sabotaged from the day after the election. He said Trump completely adamantly, angrily denied the report that Ukrainian military aid was held. Ukrainian officials reportedly helped Clinton allies. That's what Trump wants to get to the bottom of, but the press doesn't want to. Help me understand this, JR.
So there was an interview in the Wall Street Journal that was published, I think, last Friday, so a week ago, essentially, in which Johnson was quoted as saying that he, quote-unquote, winced when he first heard the allegation that the aid to Ukraine was being tied to investigating the Bidens.
Yes.
He said in that story that the president vehemently denied it. But that wince part caught people's attention because here's somebody who was saying, if that's really true, this is a problem. The setup for that Meet the Press contentious interview was Chuck Todd asking Senator Johnson about that quote, you winced. And from the get-go, Johnson was accusing him of a biased opening, the media's bias or trying to get the truth. I just want the truth. And just this very contentious interview. When I asked people about this, the theory I heard back was that, in the world of Trump, you don't want to be the president's bad side for a Republican. Ask former Senator Corker, former Senator Flake, about that, because when you on the outs with Trump,
Flake, Arizona, yes,
Bob Corker from Tennessee, it is not good for your career because the Republican base has become the Trump base, right?
Well,
it causes you issues.
Okay.
So he's the wrong side of Trump with that Wentz thing. He's maybe trying to make it right with the president by defending him.
Has he become part of the impeachment process because Representative Gwen Moore, Democrat Gwen Moore of Milwaukee, said he may now have to be called as a witness based upon his conversation with the president?
I don't know how that works at all.
Okay.
What I do wonder, though, is politically, okay, so is Johnson a reflection of the way that Republicans feel a need to defend Trump in this age? Notice a lot of U.S. senators are being quiet about his allegations. I mean, Marco Rubio of Florida, he said that he didn't think Trump was being serious about answering China to also investigate the Bidens, right? A lot of senators, though, are staying quiet. You see the most vocal defenders of the president in the House.
Yes.
My question is, for Johnson going forward, is, you know, what's he do after this? Does he continue to defend the president? And then two, how does this impact him in 2022? Because Johnson had one time said he was going to serve two terms of Senate and be done.
Yep.
Then Tony Evers won in 2018, and Dems swept all statewide offices, left Johnson as the only last man standing, in his words, essentially, among Republicans for statewide office holder. So he has talked about the possibility of seeking a third term in the U.S. Senate or running for governor in 2022. How does this help or hurt him? And as part of that subtext, like with Trump, and I've asked Republicans this, like what's the post-Republican world going to be like after Trump is gone? Either he will lose in 2020 or he'll serve a second term and be gone after 2024. What's the GOP do then? Does it become a party more like in the image of Donald Trump? Is there a cleansing and a move away from that? I don't know.
I understand.
And it's going to be fascinating with Johnson of like, how does this impact him in 2022? Of if Trump has lost in 20, are Republicans shying away from that kind of approach? They want to get pushed that away from? And with the way the impeachment stuff is going, we are set up in some ways for such intensity of either a massive win by Democrats, even possibly a massive win by Trump. It could go either way because there's just no middle ground right now in this whole thing.
But I was just so startled to have the chair of the Homeland Security Committee from Wisconsin say he doesn't trust the FBI, CIA.
And he followed up with an op-ed in The Hill, which is a D.C. publication, saying that his committee has investigated the Hillary Clinton emails, you know, which like, obviously was a big deal in the 2016 election, that after 4 years of that, he has more questions. And he listed 19 questions he wants answered, going back to one of them, like contact with Ukraine, Clinton, the Obama administration, had the 16 election.
So he's a central part of all these discussions in Washington. Okay, final subject. We got about a minute. It hasn't happened in 9 years. The governor, mm-hmm. a governor, has issued pardons. Governor Tony Evers issued pardon four. Now, let's be clear. The pardon doesn't erase or seal a conviction, but it does restore the right to own a gun, to vote, to be on a jury, to hold public office, to hold various licenses. But no one now serving a prison sentence can apply for pardon. That's Mr. Dassey and mm-hmm. the making of a murderer. The governor acted on the recommendations of a pardon advisory board, which he recreated. Those pardoned ranged in age from 36 to 62, including this gentleman who knocked somebody out after he had served duty in Iraq or mm-hmm. Afghanistan. And the governor said the four he pardoned paid their debt to society, made amends, and contributed to their communities. They deserve a second chance. Any P.S.? Because you gave Stock Picker the day off.
Two things. One, subscribe means is the low-hanging fruit. The four who were pardoned are yes. people who had charges 15, 19, 20 years ago, had a clean record since then. Two of them were low-level drug charges, people who had really straightened their lives out. The third was the Marine who had decked the guy because they got a confrontation out drinking with some friends. Fourth man broke into a tavern at 21 to steal alcohol and cigarettes for a party. Now 62.
Yes.
Had been clean since then. There's a fifth person who applied, went for the pardon advisory board in August, did not get a pardon. I'm waiting for the records and why. The question I have going forward is, this is going to get more complex with more cases. I went and did a look at the first 2 months of applications for pardons from Governor Evers. Of those, the most frequent crime that I found was a drug offense. So what's it going to be? Now, there are also people who are still in prison who applied for pardons. People who are on the sex offender registry, which makes you ineligible. Which brings me to Dassey with the prison thing. Dassey is not eligible under the criteria. However, Evers said he'd consider a pardon. He also, Dassey asked for a commutation. So I don't know how that's going to work, but that's going to be fascinating to watch what the standard is going to be going forward.
If someone formally applies for a pardon, is that a public record? Just real quickly, because we're almost out of time.
I'm not totally positive what's available.
Okay. Maybe.
I got the names.
The names are?
I got the names.
Okay.
They go before the pardon advisory board, which does a public notice about its meetings.
Okay. You gave the Stock Picker the week off?
Yes.
Okay.
Back next week with a vengeance.
Yep. next week, I'll be interviewing the co-chairs of the Assembly Task Force on Water Quality. And anything else to look for next week?
Not top of my head.
Okay, I'm Steve Walders.
I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for October 11.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.